there are songs and there are anthems.
I've heard there was a secret chord that David played and it pleased the Lord, but you don't really care for music, do you?
Now, even if you don't know this cover by Rufus Wainwright, you probably know the chorus. It's been sung by practically everyone in music, from Willie Nelson,
Hallelujah,
Susan Boyle,
Hallelujah,
Katie Lang,
Hallelujah,
even Michael Bolton.
Most people didn't come to it the way that you usually encounter a song.
This is Alan Light. He's written a new book called
The Holy or the Broken, Leonard Cohen, Jeff Buckley, and the Unlikely Ascent of Hallelujah.
Unlikely because many people who've heard Hallelujah haven't heard the original by Leonard Cohen.
I did my best. It wasn't much. I couldn't feel, so I tried to touch. I've told the truth. I didn't come.
It's that, you know, very bassy, kind of droning, dramatic delivery that's what Leonard Cohen does.
But the song almost never saw the light of day.
Columbia Records, which was Leonard's label then and remains so today, listened to the record and rejected it. Said, this is, you know, so out of step with where music is right now. Forget it.
Leonard Cohen's Hallelujah was eventually released in the U.S. in 1984 to little fanfare.
Not only was this under the radar, it was completely absent from the radar. I mean, it's as if this song had never happened.
Maybe there's a God above, but all I've ever learned from love was how to shoot somebody who outdrew you.
This 1994 cover by the late Jeff Buckley helped save Hallelujah from musical obscurity, transforming one man's lament to another's ode to love. Light says the ambiguity of the song's lyrics makes it easy for musicians to make the tune their own.
There are lyrics that are talking about sex. There are these allusions to stories from the Bible, the King David story and the Samson story. There's lots and lots of layers.
Onions have layers. Ogres have layers.
What do ogres have to do with the success of Hallelujah? Well,
it's usually identified as the Shrek song.
All thanks to a cover by John Cale used in a sad scene in Shrek, the hit animated film. And ever since, Light says Hallelujah is a go-to emotional trigger in TV shows and movies.
You know what you're supposed to feel when you hear that song. You can't even hear it anymore. You just know that's the song that's supposed to make me feel sad now.
Still, Light says at a time when the way we encounter music has become so fragmented, the endurance of this song nearly 30 years after it was first released and dozens of covers later is remarkable.
And you see that this is a song that people use at weddings, at funerals, at very deeply personal things. I don't know, it was really kind of humbling when it's very easy to discount and think, oh, music isn't. It used to be important to people and now it's not that important. A song like this, you witness just how important it can still be for huge swaths of people.
Alan Light. His book is called The Holy or the Broken, Leonard Cohen, Jeff Buckley, Hallelujah, and the Unlikely Ascent of Hallelujah. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin.
Hallelujah. Hallelujah.
Let's hear now how an old beloved cultural touchstone in this country is being reworked for a contemporary audience. It's a long-running public TV show for kids. NPR's Mandalit Del Barco reports.
PBS canceled Reading Rainbow in 2006 after 23 years of teaching children about the joys of literature, but it lives again on YouTube with its host LeVar Burton in auto-tune.
There are stories everywhere you look, if you look in the right way. New castles to build, mysteries to be solved.
The remix is a mashup of clips with Burton encouraging young viewers to read. This year, Burton also launched an app that repurposes content from the original TV show. He told the website TechCrunch that fans are also reworking the theme song.
A reading rainbow, reading rainbow,
reading rainbow.
There's an ownership. People feel like Reading Rainbow is theirs. And so you get the sublime and sometimes the ridiculous.
The Reading Rainbow auto-tune version is just the latest in PBS's new Icons Remixed series. It started last summer with the classic Mr. Rogers, lacing up his sneakers and singing to kids.
It's good to be curious about many things. You can think about things and make believe.
And Bob Ross talking about painting landscapes.
Let's build a happy little cloud. Let's build some happy little trees.
And Julia Child reveling in the joy of cooking.
Cooking, cooking, keep on cooking. This is the way to eat. Bon appetit.
Right, this crazy auto-tune thing.
Jason Sycan is vice president of PBS Interactive.
We decided that we really needed to take a different approach and get much more in tune with the gestalt of the web, retain the PBS quality, but put a YouTube sensibility around it.
Sycan says the first three videos had more than 13 million views and thousands of comments from people nostalgic for their old PBS favorites.
The comments kind of mostly fall into a couple categories. I can't believe I'm crying man tears over this. And I can't believe this is an official PBS production.
Now PBS is asking its digital audience to decide who to auto-tune next. How about Bob Vila fixing up an old house, or Alistair Cook from Masterpiece Theater? Mandalit del Barco, NPR News.
Butterfly in the sky, I can go twice as high. Take a look, it's in a book, a reading rainbow.
This is NPR News.
Think of those great writers who have made their hometowns literary history. William Faulkner, Zora Neale Hurston, Thomas Wolfe. Well, now Susan Strait is getting praise for her portrayal of Riverside, California. It's a small city in the high desert, an hour east of Los Angeles, right at the foothills of the rugged San Bernardino Mountains. NPR's Karen Grigsby Bates visited the author in the place that is both her home and inspiration.
Read any of Susan Strait's 10 books and you hear tales of a tight-knit black community in a working-class neighborhood with voices that sound lively and real. Then you meet Strait and do a double take. She's petite and blonde. When she was interviewed at last year's Texas Book Festival, she said she sounds the way she sounds because of where she calls home.
I still live in the same place I've lived all my life. And even though I look like this, most of the characters are black or mixed race, because that's the community that I live in.
Many residents, like Strait's former in-laws, fled oppressive conditions in the segregated South. Several of the stories Strait's neighbors and family handed down to her end up in her books, although it can take a while for them to get there. A riveting story an elderly family friend told her decades ago made its way into Between Heaven and Here, her latest novel in a trilogy that spans three centuries.
Mr. Gaynor, we're going to drive by his house.
As she gives a tour of Riverside, Strait says this is what Louis Gaynor told her about almost starving when he was a small child living in rural Florida with his widowed mother.
I was so hungry, and I was so angry about it, that one day I knew where there was a pig in the woods, and I got a hammer, and I walked 3 miles to where that pig was, and I killed it with my hammer, and I dragged it back home. And I put it in the yard, and I told my mother, I'm tired of being hungry. I want you to cook me some meat.
Susan Strait says she tells these Riverside stories so true personal histories of ordinary people live on. An audience at a TEDx lecture heard how she translated the pigtail into her latest book.
I wrote a story about a man who is orphaned during the 1927 Mississippi River flood in Louisiana. And he's on the banks of the levee, and he's starving. and there are other people starving too. And he's so desperate, he's 7 years old, that he finds a pig that's been abandoned, he kills it with a hammer, and he drags it back.
Strait teaches creative writing at the University of California, Riverside. She tells students in one class she got the pig story by using a critical skill all writers need.
The best thing I can say is that you do have to be a really good listener. If I go to a family reunion and there's 400 people there, everybody comes up and tells me the story, right? And I think that when you're a good listener, then you can imagine how someone's talking. Dialogue is your key friend, is it not?
Listening well has paid off. Susan Strait's work has been praised by the Washington Post, the New York Times, Kirkus, and fellow writers such as Walter Mosley. They say she creates dialogue that allows her characters to speak for themselves. She is successful enough that she could live someplace bigger or, as others might put it, better, but she won't.
And this is 12th Street.
She loves every inch of Riverside and points out places of personal significance as she drives around.
My father-in-law used to own a little slice of property over there.
So she's staying put. As a reminder, there are two portraits in Strait's house. One is of Flannery O'Connor, who produced revered classics from her home in Milledgeville, Georgia. The other is of Eudora Welty, who did the same from her permanent perch in Jackson, Mississippi. Strait says when she feels guilty about not wanting to leave home, she remembers Welty's fine portrait of a formal Southern wedding with all its hidden undercurrents.
And I think how amazing it was that she chronicled her small town of Jackson with that kind of love, and she stayed there. And I think, well, if it was okay for them, it's all right for me.
It has been so far, and there are plenty of Riverside stories yet to share. Karen Grigsby Bates, NPR News.
We have an update now on the planet Krypton. It is Superman's home, and a renowned astrophysicist discovered the exact location of the planet just in time for Superman to get a glimpse of it. Superman was able to watch his planet blow up, seeing a dazzling light display that took 27 years to reach the planet Earth. Now, the scientist who helped the Man of Steel locate his home planet in the galaxy, none other than Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson, who, faster than a speeding bullet, joins us in our studio this morning. Dr. Tyson, good morning.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, it's good for you to be here. I'm having troubles keeping a straight face.
What
really happened here? I mean, it is true that you somehow have gotten roped into a Superman comic.
Well, I roped in can't be the right reference there. I gleefully accepted the invitation.
No arm twisting.
To assist Superman in his time of need. Wouldn't you?
Sure. Okay. I mean, if he asked.
If Elastic Man called, no. Or Aquaman. But Superman is a special place in the pantheon of superheroes. I got a call from DC Comics.
Uh-huh.
And they said that they wanted to create an issue where Superman would visit the Hayden Planetarium, where I serve as director
in New York City.
And they wanted to portray the planetarium in the comic. So they wanted sort of permission to do that. And we said, sure. And then they wanted to know if they could portray me in conversation with Superman, showing him Krypton. So I said, sure.
Okay, right? Why not?
Why not? But then I said, well, wait a minute. What's going on in the story? Well, in the story, Superman observes the destruction of Krypton.
Because it takes a long time for light from that explosion.
Well,
to
so
the
then I said, well, if that's the case, let's explore the astrophysics of this. I mean, why not? They were just ready to draw it and just make the story up. I said, we might be able to anchor this with real data. How old is Superman? He said, well, we never specify, but we say about late 20s. So I said, well, let's get a star that's late 20s light years away. All right. Now, remember when he arrived at Earth, he was an infant. When he was launched from Krypton, he was an infant. So he didn't age at all, essentially. So there are two ways he could have gotten here. Traveling at most of the speed of light, where you hardly age at all, or traveling through a wormhole.
Mm.
If you travel through a wormhole, you beat the light beam that left your planet.
And so Superman traveled through a wormhole?
Well, we have to assert that.
We have to assume that, right?
If he now sees 27 years later the destruction of Krypton, he essentially got here instantly on this little Moses-style basket that was cast into space.
Through the wormhole.
It had to be through a wormhole.
Okay, so Superman gets here instantly through a wormhole. 27 years after the explosion of Krypton, he's able to see it, this planet in theory.
He comes to the planetarium, and my character as portrayed, it is me. I mean, it's a cameo for me in the comic.
Yeah.
I'm wearing my trademark vest, and I And they
with the
even
sun's on it.
Yeah, and I said, oh, by the way, if it makes no difference one to you, could you take off a few pounds for me?
you gave them advice. Huh?
And they said, Dr. Tyson, these are the comics. Everyone looks good.
Well, I'm looking at it right here. You look very good.
I know. I'm pretty buff in the comic. Yeah. I could be buff in the comic.
Well, and just to be clear, that you actually did find a planet that, based on all these specs, no, could be Krypton.
Well, we didn't. We can't see actual planets at that distance. You can infer their presence. And I said, we can show sort of the what we call the light curve of the host star, where a star dims a little bit when the planet eclipses it. But they wanted something more dramatic. And I said, well, then we have to construct a new way to observe the universe for this episode. And so what I said was, let's gather all the telescopes of the world, have them look at this particular star. I found them a star 27 light years away, a red star. And we know that Superman's home star was red.
Huh.
So I got this, right?
You got it.
Right? And if you're into the idea of the star, it's LHS 2520, if you care.
Okay.
All right.
All you amateur astronomers are listening.
Exactly.
Listening up right there.
And so I hand them this star. They said, that's it. Let's use that. And then we invent the notion of a planet orbiting it, and we call that planet Krypton.
All right.
And so we got that covered. And we assemble the armament of all the telescopes of the world to observe that star system.
You have that power to assemble all the telescopes
in the comics,
of the world.
Yes, I had that power.
Okay.
To assemble all telescopes of the world to turn the entire Earth into one coherent telescope.
Wow.
All right. If all the telescopes observe the same object at the same time and you bring the data together in a particular way, you can create what's called an interferometer. We do this all the time, but not on this scale, and we haven't figured out how to do it on this scale yet.
Normally, all the telescopes would not all agree to do this
exactly.
For just the sake of a comic book, but in theory, this could happen.
In the comics. So not only would they not agree to do it, it would be very hard to do. It's also a challenge beyond our current capacity to assemble the data in such a way to make one coherent image. And I said, we don't know how to do that. And in the comic, they said, don't worry. Superman will.
you and Superman, quite a team.
Oh, my gosh. So I'm now buds with Superman. And so he comes in, and I say, I can't make sense of these data. And he stands over the computer, and his mind goes to the computer, and out comes this image beautifully displayed on the dome of the Hayden Planetarium. And it is, I'd hate to give away the story, but he sees the destruction of his planet.
Wow.
And he went, and he's been coming every year, apparently, as the story tells it, and knowing that this year would be different from the others. And it's a rather solemn story. I mean, at the end, his head is bowed.
He
and
got emotional.
He's sad. I even got a little misty-eyed as I just read through this, because here's something he knew already happened, but to see it takes it into another emotional realm.
Did you give him a hug?
It was a huggable moment. Maybe the next panel would have had me hugging him, but the end with him just sort of bowing his head in solemn reflection of what he just witnessed.
Well, you look great in a comic book. You look great in our studios. Thanks for coming by.
Well, thanks for having me. It was great being buds with Superman. Like I said, I would not have done it for Aquaman.
Superman's another thing.
Also, I must say, I'm a longtime resident of Metropolis. You know, I'm a native New Yorker, so
yeah.
I get to think of that as Metropolis.
You owed him something.
I think so. I mean, he's been good to us all my life. So the least I could do is help the man find his home star. So this was, I felt an important bit of civic, personal, emotional, intellectual duty to serve that role.
And you can read the story in Superman Action Comic, Dr. Tyson. Which one is it?
Yeah, Action Comics 14.
There you have it.
It's there now. I went to my local comic store, and they had like a whole stack of them. I bought the whole stack. There might not be any left for you. I don't know.
I mean, how many people could say they met Superman? Neil deGrasse Tyson did, and he was here to talk about it. The astrophysicist is director of the Hayden Planetarium and a frequent guest on this program. It is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green.
And I'm Renee Montaigne.
Agatha Christie is the best-selling murder writer of all time, and she created two of the best-known detectives in crime fiction, Ms. Jane Marple, and of course...
My name is Poirot. Hercule Poirot.
Peter Ustinov was just one of the actors to take on the role of Poirot.
Might want to ask, what are you doing here?
I'm only vacances. Shortly, I'm going up the Nile on the steamer.
But before she ever wrote Death on the Nile or Murder on the Orient Express, Agatha Christie took her own, less perilous journey in 1922 when she set sail on a trip around the world, including South Africa and Australia. Now, Agatha Christie's grandson, Matthew Pritchard, has edited and published the letters that Agatha Christie wrote while on that journey. They're all compiled in a book called The Grand Tour, Around the World with the Queen of Mystery. I spoke with Pritchard from the BBC studios in London about his grandmother and what those letters revealed.
I was in my mid-30s when she died. I know grandsons, you tend to think of them as children. You can't see me, but I'm hardly a child. And, you know, I knew her as well as anybody, probably, you know, during the latter half of her life.
So let's talk about this grand tour, this journey around the world chronicled in this book. She and your grandfather, Archie, traveled to what were then colonies in the British Empire. And all along the way, Agatha Christie is chronicling her journey by writing letters to her mother.
That is right, yes.
Did she have a close relationship with her mother?
The closest, I think. I think the trip is notable for several reasons. I mean, not only because now my grandmother is such a famous person, but it exhibits all sorts of things about the 1920s, the first of which, I suppose, is the art of letter writing, which I sometimes think we've forgotten about completely these days. The other thing is that, of course, whilst you read the letters, you learn of the comparative simplicity of communications in those days. I mean, no emails, hardly any telephones. Communications with her three-year-old daughter, who they left behind, were rudimentary. And how many mothers these days would leave a three-year-old child in the care of a nanny and a sister and a mother? You know, it seems very strange to us, but in those sort of times it wasn't perhaps quite so unusual.
You mentioned the lost art of letter writing and how this book tries to recapture some of that. Do you have one or two favorite letters that are included in the book?
I do. I'll just read you one, which is quite short, written to her daughter, which says, "My darling little girl, some butterflies for you from Mummy and Daddy, and a picture of Pretoria where Mummy and Daddy are. There are no choo-choos," that means trains, I think, "so they will have to stay there for a long time. Mummy had brought a bottle of Burgundy, but now martial law has come and they have locked it up in the bar. I think about you such a lot, my own baby. I shall come back by and by to my little Rosalind. Lots of love from Mummy."
I'd like to ask you about that. It was a big deal to leave behind her small daughter. What was so important to your grandmother about this journey?
You know, in those days, she couldn't really foresee a time when she'd ever be able to visit these places ever again. So it was partly duty to accompany her husband, which was very strong in those days, and partly, quite honestly, opportunity.
Your grandmother's mysteries, viewed through a kind of modern lens, can appear to be these rather quaint stories, but they are still so captivating to so many readers. Why do you think that is so?
I think they are simple. They reflect people who appear in most people's lives. So people, when they read the books, they feel quite comfortable with the characters. They are easily adaptable, whether to different languages or to television. And I think that, you know, you can pick up an Agatha Christie and in, what, 4 or 5 hours, you can lose yourself in a world of mystery and contentment.
Well, thank you, Miss Marple, for the tea. Oh,
a pleasure, Colonel, and I wish you the best of luck.
Thank you.
One of those cases, isn't it, when one could so easily find oneself barking up the wrong tree?
What tree might that be?
For example, one might be asking oneself why the girl was either killed here and taken to Colonel Bantry's, or why she was taken there first and then killed.
Yes.
But that, of course, would be the wrong question, wouldn't it?
Do you still pick up one of your grandmother's books from time to time? Do you have them in your house, on your bookshelves?
I'm afraid I do, yes. I mean, you're just about to ask me which is my favourite one, I suspect.
Yeah, maybe.
Well, I have a favourite story called Endless Night, which was written right at the end of her life in about 1967. And it had this almost eerie feeling that evil really exists, which I know from talking to her, she really believed in. And it was a hugely modern book. Fewer people read that than other of her more famous books now, because it doesn't have Poirot or Miss Marple in it. But any of your listeners who can pick up a copy of Endless Night, I can highly recommend it to them.
Before I let you go, I do want to ask you about the photograph on the cover of this book. It's a lovely picture of your grandmother. I wonder if you could just tell me what you like about this photo.
Well, she's on a boat, but you know that doesn't tell you much, because you will have worked that out for yourself. But I think happy. You would say relaxed, wouldn't you? somebody who was quite at peace with herself and where she was at. And I think, for my mind, that and one other picture in the book in a sort of floral one-piece dress are perhaps the best representations of what I think, you know, what a happy state of mind she was on this trip. And I think that that reflects itself not only in the photographs in the book, a lot of which, by the way, she took herself, and in the tone of the letters. You know, I think it is a marvellous recreation of life and almost a part of social history that she gives us a glimpse of in the letters and photographs.
The book is called The Grand Tour, Around the World with the Queen of Mystery, Agatha Christie. Agatha Christie's grandson, Matthew Pritchard, edited the book, and he joined us from the BBC. Mr. Pritchard, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.